As we approached the village, I saw that everyone was gathering toward the central area with the stage in the middle. I guessed there was going to be a show after all. People came in from the fields, emptied from their huts, and generally left whatever they were doing to crowd around the platform. I was all set to join the crowd when Osa grabbed my hand and pulled me in another direction. The three of us climbed on top of one of the stone huts and positioned ourselves on the roof so we could get a good view of the show.
"They must not see us," cautioned Osa. "We are not a part of this."
"Whatever, no biggie. We had the best view in the house anyway." So I settled in and wondered what the performance was going to be. Maybe some Milago musicians, or some school play thing. I looked out on the meeting ground and saw the Milago villagers gathered in a wide circle around the central platform, which wasn't empty anymore. On top of it was some kind of contraption that looked like a seesaw. On one end was a seat, on the other was a big, wide-mouthed basket. Standing on the platform next to the gizmo was one of Kagan's knights, beating on a drum. I hoped the purpose of this guy was to signal for everyone to gather, because if this was the whole show, I wasn't impressed. The deep booming sound echoed across the village. His rhythm was pretty lousy, too. Standing next to the platform were six more knights. They stood at attention, each holding a nasty-looking spear in front of them. The Milago villagers gave these guys a wide berth. I would have, too. They didn't look friendly. It started to dawn on me that none of these people looked as if they were getting ready for a good time. There wasn't an excited air of anticipation that comes before a fun event. No one spoke, or laughed, or joked. Except for the booming drum, it was deathly quiet. These people all had a look of dread on their faces. Osa then tapped me on the shoulder and pointed to the far side of the clearing. I looked to see a group of four Milago villagers walking slowly toward the assembly. They were all men who were covered with dirt from head to toe. Not that any of these Milago people were all that clean to begin with, but these guys were pretty gnarly. The black dirt really stood out boldly against their pasty white skin. The four men were carrying a large basket filled with craggy rocks of all sizes. Some were as large as bowling balls. Others were much smaller. But the thing that really stood out about them was that they were blue. And I mean bright blue, like dazzling sapphires. I had never seen anything so stunning.
"The stones are called glaze," whispered Osa. "There are mines throughout this area. The Milago mine for glaze day and night."
"Well, I guess it's valuable," I said, stating the obvious.
"Very," she answered. "Glaze is the foremost reason why Kagan wants to keep control over the Milago. Glaze has made the Bedouin wealthy. They trade with merchants from all of Denderon. So long as the Milago mine for glaze, Kagan remains a powerful monarch."
So Kagan and the Bedouin weren't only lazy bullies, they were greedy bullies who forced the Milago to do their dirty work. Huh, nice guys. I wanted to ask more questions, but suddenly the drummer stopped pounding, and an ominous silence fell over the village. The four miners brought the basket of glaze to the platform and carefully placed it down. The whole thing was starting to take on the air of a ceremony. The transfer is what Lore called it. That's when I heard the sound of a galloping horse. Someone was coming straight down the path where we had walked out to the ocean, and he was coming fast. The weird thing was, nobody turned to look. Nobody but me, that is. As the horse came charging out of the forest, I saw that riding it was a guy who looked like he knew what he was doing. He was a big guy with long dark hair, wearing some kind of leather armor similar to what the knights had on, but his armor didn't look like it had seen many battles. It was clean and unscarred, unlike the knight's armor, which looked pretty beaten up. As he galloped up to the circle of villagers, they parted to give him access to the platform. Good thing, too, because he didn't slow down. I think if the people hadn't moved, he would have plowed over them. Already I didn't like this guy. Is that Kagan? I whispered.
Osa and Lore exchanged secret looks, like there was something going on that they didn't want to tell me about. I caught the look, and I didn't like it.
His name is Malos, answered Osa. He is Kagan's chief advisor.
Malos, Kagan, Osa, Lore, Figgis. Was I the only guy around here who had a first and a last name? This Malos guy rode his horse right up to the platform and stopped. My guess was the show was about to begin. He sat there on his horse and surveyed the assembled crowd like he owned them. None of the Milago returned his look. They all stood with their heads down, avoiding his gaze. It didn't take a genius to figure out that they were afraid of him. Malos then turned in his saddle and looked right up to where we were hiding on the roof.
"Stay down," ordered Lore with a strong whisper.
We all ducked down further, trying to press ourselves into the roof to make ourselves smaller. But I could still see Malos. As his horse kicked at the dirt, he sat there, stock still, looking toward us. It was like he knew we were there. But that was impossible. There was no way he could have seen us.
That's when it happened. As I looked back at him, I was hit with a realization so shocking that it made me gasp in surprise. I think the thing that tipped it were his eyes. As far away as he was, I knew those cold blue eyes. How could I forget?
Osa and Lore both sensed my surprise and looked at me questioningly.
"Saint Dane," I said softly.
"You know him?"
whispered Lore with total shock.
"Yeah, he tried to kill me back on Earth just before I got flumed here," I said.
I couldn't believe those words had just come out of my mouth. There was a lot going on in that one little sentence. It would have sounded like fantasy about 24 hours ago, but right now it made all too much sense. Osa and Lore exchanged concerned looks again. Then Lore whispered to me,
"He followed you to Second Earth?"
She said this as if it were an amazing thing to have happened. I shrugged and nodded a silent yes. It was the first time she looked at me with something other than total disdain. Up until now, she acted as if I were less important than the dirt on her boots. But now her look was one of, well, curiosity. Maybe the fact that I survived an encounter with Saint Dane proved that I wasn't so soft after all. Of course, I wasn't about to tell her that all I did was run for my life. I wasn't an idiot. Looking down at Saint Dane, or Malos, or whatever he called himself, I got hit with a strong wave of, "I want to go home." But that wasn't going to happen any time soon. I was stuck here looking at a guy who had tried to kill me. Could he see me? Was he going to kick that horse into gear and come charging toward the hut? We'd be trapped up here on the roof. All I could do was hold my breath. It felt like a lifetime. But Saint Dane finally turned away. I could breathe again. With a wave of his hand, he said sharply,
"Begin."
Whoa! He spoke English. Did that mean he knew English? Or that he, too, was a traveler, and that's why I could understand him?
That question would have to wait, for the main event finally began. One of the miners who had carried in the basket of glaze stepped forward. He was a big guy, and something about the way he carried himself told me he was in charge. Whatever was about to happen, this guy didn't seem too happy about it. Every move he made was stiff and forced, as if the pressure of doing what he had to do was physically painful.
"That is Relan," whispered Osa. "He is the chief miner."
Guess I nailed that one. Of course, he was another one-name guy. Relan stepped up onto the platform and turned to the crowd. He then held out his hand and gestured to someone. The crowd parted, and a man stepped forward to join him on the platform. He was a tall, skinny guy, which I point out only because of what happened next. The skinny guy walked over to the seesaw thing and sat down on the end with the seat. Since there was no weight on the other side, he tipped his end down to the floor of the platform. Relin gestured to the other miners, and the three guys lugged the basket of glaze up onto the platform, placing it near the opposite end of the seesaw. What were they going to do? Measure the guy's weight in glaze?
They make a transfer every day, explained Osa. Malos chooses one of the Malago, and that determines how much glaze they must mine for Kagan the next day.
I was right. Measuring the guy's weight in glaze was exactly what they were going to do. The big seesaw was a scale. The miners reached into the basket of glaze and were about to pick up the first few stones to begin the process when St. Dane barked,
"No!"
The miners stopped. Everyone held their breath, waiting for St. Dane's next move. St. Dane surveyed the crowd, then pointed.
"Him,"
he said with no emotion. There was a general rumbling of discontent within the crowd. Two of the knights pushed roughly past a few of the villagers and grabbed the man St. Dane had pointed to. He was a much bigger man than the first guy. The rules had just changed, and Relin didn't like it.
"Maloska!"
he shouted. He was ticked and started yelling angrily at St. Dane. I won't write the words as I heard them because, as you know, his language made no sense to me. I'll just tell you the translation that Osa gave me.
"Malos has chosen a different subject for the transfer, and Relin is telling him that it is not fair,"
Osa explained, though I pretty much figured that out on my own.
"He is pleading with Malos to use the choice he made yesterday."
I could see why. This new guy was much heavier than the original guy. If they had mined enough of the glaze to balance with the first guy, there was no way they'd have enough to balance with the second guy. Relin begged St. Dane for fairness. St. Dane didn't flinch. He looked at Relin like he was a bug. Then one of the knights stepped up to Relin and slapped him on the side of the face with his spear. Relin spun around and I could see the fiery anger in his eyes. He was already bleeding from the smack on his cheek. I could tell he was a breath away from leaping at the knight's throat. But he didn't. That was smart because the other knights were standing right there, ready with their weapons. He would have been hammered.
"Look at me, Relin," commanded St. Dane.
Relin looked up at his enemy on the horse.
"Being a loyal subject, you should want to do more for Kagan than is expected of you,"
St. Dane said with an arrogance that even made my blood boil.
"Are you telling me that you are doing the least amount of work that is necessary,
Relin answered with a seething yet controlled tirade that Osa translated for me.
"He is arguing that mining glaze is difficult and dangerous. Every ounce they pull from the mines comes at a huge cost. He says they mine as much as they possibly can."
St. Dane snickered and said,
"We will see."
He then gestured to the knights. One of them jumped up onto the platform, grabbed the skinny guy who was sitting on the end of the seesaw, and pushed him off the platform. Then the other two knights dragged the heavyset guy up onto the platform and jammed him down into the seat. This guy was scared. He looked to Relin with pleading eyes, but there was nothing Relin could do.
"Now," said St. Dane, "you may begin."
The miners looked to Relin, who gave them a slight nod. They had no choice. So they went to work taking the glaze from their basket and putting the stones on the opposite end of the seesaw.
"What happens if they don't make the weight?"
I asked Osa.
"Let us hope you do not have to find out,"
came her ominous answer. The miners quickly placed the glaze stones on the scale, starting with the larger ones and working their way down to the marble-sized ones. The villagers' eyes were all focused on the scale. My guess is that no one was breathing. I know I wasn't. When the miners were about halfway through, the seesaw began to move. Ever so slowly, the heavy man on the opposite end of the scale began to rise.
As soon as he felt himself move, a look of relief came over his face. Maybe there would be enough glaze stones to balance him after all. With renewed hope, the miners continued to pile the stones on the scale. Slowly the scale moved, and the heavy-set man rose into the air. I could feel the mood of the crowd beginning to turn. They were going to do it. They had mined more than enough glaze that day, just as St. Dane had demanded. With the last few small stones, the scale rose until it was perfectly level. It took every last one they had, but they made it. If this had been a World Series game, the crowd would have erupted into a cheer. But this was no game. Even though I could sense their joy and relief, no one made a peep. I saw them secretly exchanging little smiles of joy. There were even a few quick secret hugs. It was a good moment. Even Relan looked relieved, though he tried not to show it. Throwing victory back in St. Dane's face would not have been a smart thing to do. St. Dane didn't react. I couldn't tell if he was happy they had mined so much extra glaze, or ticked that the Milago had met his unfair challenge. He swung his leg over and jumped down from his horse. He climbed up onto the platform and looked at the level scale with a slight smile. Suddenly the mood of the crowd grew tense again. What was St. Dane doing? He looked to the heavy-set man who was swaying on the end of the scale. The man looked down, afraid to make eye contact. St. Dane then walked to the end of the scale where the glaze stones were piled into the basket.
"Well done, Relan," he said. "You have mined quite a large amount of..."
He suddenly stopped talking and leaned in closer to the basket of glazed stones. Throughout the crowd, people started holding one another's hands for strength. St. Dane gazed into the basket of stones and said,
"Well, then, I am surprised at you. There is a stone in here that is not pure glaze."
Uh-oh. Relan made a move to run to the basket, but two of the knights held him back. Relan yelled something at St. Dane, but it didn't matter what he said. St. Dane reached into the basket, grabbed the largest glazed stone, and picked it up. Instantly, the scale tipped, and the heavy-set man slammed down onto the platform, hard. St. Dane carried the stone over to Relan and held it up to his face.
"You know that Kagan only accepts stones of pure glaze," he said through smug, clenched teeth.
Not that I'm a geology expert or anything, but that stone looked just like every other stone in the batch. St. Dane was changing the rules again.
"Oh, you know what must happen now," he said with mock sadness.
Apparently the heavyset man knew it too. He scrambled to his feet and jumped down off the platform. He wanted out of there, fast. But the knights grabbed him and held him tight.
"What's happening?"
I asked Osa. Osa didn't answer. She kept staring at the scene with sad eyes. I figured I was going to find the answer soon anyway, and turned back to watch the last act of this drama. One of the other knights quickly grabbed a heavy chain that was attached to one end of the wooden platform. He pulled on it, and half of the platform top lifted up like a trap door. Underneath, there looked like... nothing. The platform was built over a huge hole.
"It is the first mine shaft that was dug here in the Milago village,"
Osa said, without taking her sad eyes off the scene.
"It is a pit that reaches down farther than the eye can see. I am afraid there are many lonely bones resting on the bottom."
My mind was racing. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. They were going to toss this guy down the mine shaft.
"Why don't the Milago do something?" I said. "There are hundreds of them. Why don't they stop it?"
The knights dragged the heavy-set man closer to the open pit.
"Baga, baga, vapor da pe!" he cried.
It was horrible. No one in the crowd moved. No one tried to help the poor guy. Even Relan. It was like they knew it was futile. I noticed that next to me, Lore reached to her back and grabbed hold of her wooden weapon. But Ossa put her hand over her daughter's.
"You know it is not the time," she said softly.
Lore didn't release her weapon at first. I could feel her tension. One push and she would be down there, swinging away. But today was not that day. She kept her eyes on the scene and released her grip on the weapon. The knights dragged the screaming heavy man up to St. Dane, who looked at the poor guy without a trace of sympathy and said,
"If you weren't such a glutton, you may have lived to see another day."
St. Dane then nodded at the knights, and they dragged the poor screaming man toward the open pit.
"Ka! Ka!" he pleaded. "Maga Kondala Pei! Maga Kondala! My full wife and two children, please! I must take care of them! They will be alone!"
The scene was so horrifying that it wasn't until later that it hit me. I could understand him. It sure sounded like English, but it didn't make sense that he suddenly would have switched languages. Ossa said that the travelers had the ability to understand all languages, and since I was suddenly able to understand this man, maybe I was a traveler after all. But I didn't think about that until later. Right now I was witnessing the most gut-wrenching moment I could imagine. The two knights dragged the heavy man closer to the open pit. Suddenly a woman jumped out of the crowd and tried to pull him away from his executioners. She was in tears and begging for mercy. She must have been the man's wife, but her brave effort didn't help. She was quickly grabbed by another knight and thrown to the ground. She lay there in the grass, sobbing. The knights finally got the man to the edge of the pit and were about to push him in when the man suddenly stopped wailing. Up until this point, he had been crying and begging for his life, but now he stopped fighting and stood up straight. I swear, there was a look on his face that was almost calm. The knights didn't know how to react. They weren't used to someone being calm during the worst moment of their life. The heavy man turned and faced St. Dane, and in a distinct, strong voice he said,
"My only regret is that I will not live long enough to see Kagan suffer the way we have all suffered."
St. Dane chuckled and said, "None of you will live that long, for that day will never come." He then gave a quick, almost imperceptible nod, and the two knights pushed the doomed man backward into the pit. His wife screamed, but the guy didn't let out a sound. 1 second he was there. The next he was just gone. Hopefully his death would be quick, and he'd now be in a better place than this horrible village. The knight holding the chain let it go, and the wooden platform fell down with a boom. St. Dane walked up to Relan, who looked him right in the eye. St. Dane then pointed to the man's sobbing wife.
"We will use her for tomorrow's transfer," he said with pleasure. "She seems quite light. It should make for an easy day. Please thank me for being so considerate."
Relan looked at St. Dane, and for a second I thought he was going to spit in his face. But he didn't. Instead, he gritted his teeth and said,
"Thank you."
"You're welcome,"
St. Dane said with a smile. With that, he strode to his horse, jumped into the saddle, and was just about to ride off when he once again looked back toward us. Actually, it was more like he was looking right at me. I could feel it. He knew I was there. Was all of this a show for me? St. Dane laughed, kicked his horse and rode off through the stunned crowd back toward the Bedouin palace. The knights pushed a few of the miners toward the basket of glaze with their spears. The valuable stones had to be delivered to Kagan, and it was clear that they weren't the ones who were going to carry them. That was a job for their slaves. The miners picked up the basket from the seesaw and started the long walk toward the palace. The rest of the villagers slowly started to disperse. Not a word was spoken. A few people went up to console the poor woman who had just lost her husband, but most simply headed back toward their homes. They had been through this horror before, and they probably would go through it again. But I hadn't. I was frantic. I had just witnessed a man murdered in cold blood. It was even more horrible than the poor homeless guy who St. Dane hypnotized into running into the subway train back in New York. That was awful, but it didn't seem real. This was very, very real, and I didn't understand it. My emotions were all over the place, and yes, I'm not ashamed to admit it, I was crying. They were tears of anger and fear and sadness for a man I didn't even know, and for his family. I didn't care that I was crying in front of Lore or anybody else. I was out of control. "Why didn't they do something?" I shouted at Osa. "They could have ganged up on the knights. They could have pulled the guy away. Why didn't they stop it?" Osa was as calm as I was upset. She said, "If they had done anything, Kagan would have sent an army to punish them. They had no choice." I looked to Lore and was surprised to see that she too looked upset. She may not have been ranting the way I was, but her icy calm was cracked. I even thought I could see a tear in her eye. Maybe there was a heart beneath that tough exterior after all. Still, I didn't buy what Osa was saying. "Well, so what? They should have done something," I cried. "If they don't do something, it'll never stop." Osa put a hand on my shoulder, and I could feel myself starting to calm down. But what she said next was the last thing I wanted to hear. "They are going to do something, Pendragon. They are going to take destiny into their own hands and rise up against Kagan. That is why we are here. We are going to help them. You are going to help them." These words hit me like a bolt from the blue. Uncle Press had told me there were people who needed our help, but I had no idea he was talking about an entire village of people who were at the mercy of a vicious army that didn't think twice about killing people in cold blood. This was crazy. I felt bad for these people, but there was nothing I could do to help them. I didn't care how tough this Lore person was. Those knights were killers, and there were only three of us, or four if you counted Uncle Press. What good could we do against an army? No, this was crazy. I made up my mind right there that the first chance I got, I'd get away from these nutburgers and get back to that flume thing. If it brought me here, then there had to be a way for it to get me back home. Yes, that was the answer. I was going to get myself out of here and kiss this place goodbye, with or without Uncle Press.
Second Earth.
"Hey, you kids!"
Mark and Courtney looked up from their reading to see Sergeant D'Angelo calling to them from the front of the building. The two had been sitting there the whole time reading the pages from Bobby.
"Run!"
yelled Mark. He started to get up, but Courtney grabbed him by the seat of the pants and pulled him back down.
"Why?" she asked him calmly. "We're not doing anything wrong."
Mark had to think about that for a second. She was right. All they were doing was sitting in the alley reading. Nothing illegal about that. So then why was this policeman yelling at them? Courtney looked to the cop, but didn't budge.
"What do you want?"
she yelled.
"I want to talk to you,"
came the reply.
"Then you come to us,"
Courtney yelled.
Ouch,
Mark winced. Courtney was being pretty disrespectful. Okay, so maybe the guy dissed them before, but he was still a cop. Mark was sure he was going to arrest them. D'Angelo took a few steps toward them with his hands on his hips and said in a downright civil tone,
"I want to talk to you about the Pendragons."
"Why?"
asked Courtney, oozing skepticism.
"Because I believe you," answered D'Angelo.
Mark and Courtney shot each other a look. Victory! He must have found Mr. and Mrs. Pendragon. They both jumped up to go to the cop. Mark made sure that Bobby's half-read journal was tucked securely in his pack, and the two followed D'Angelo back into the station house. Once inside, the sergeant led them past the lobby and continued on through the back offices. Mark thought this was kind of cool. He had never been behind the scenes at a real police station. The experience wasn't exactly what he had expected. On TV, police stations had a lot of activity. There were always cops leading handcuffed perps toward interrogation rooms, and detectives taking statements and SWAT teams hurrying to some mission, and generally a ton of cop-type hubbub. But not here in Stony Brook. Here a guy was making a phone call to Domino's for pizza, and another guy looked bored while playing Free Cell on an old computer. Not exactly a beehive of electrifying police activity. Very disappointing.
"I gotta be honest," said D'Angelo as he led them through the station. "I thought you two were pulling a number on me until I spoke with Captain Hirsch."
"What did he say?"
Mark asked.
"Ask him yourself," said the sergeant, as he opened a door and motioned for Mark and Courtney to enter.
The two walked into a conference room with a large metal table surrounded by 8 chairs. It was a plain room with a huge mirror that covered most of one wall. Sitting at the head of the table was a pleasant-looking man wearing a suit. When the kids entered, he stood up and smiled, but both kids sensed that he was troubled. Good. He should be. There were troubling things going down.
"Hi, guys. I'm Captain Hirsch," the man said. "Thanks for coming back."
Courtney went right up to the mirror and stuck her nose to the glass while cupping her eyes to block out the light.
"This a two-way mirror?" she asked. "Who's back there? You interrogating us?"
Hirsch looked to D'Angelo and the two chuckled.
"Yes, it's a two-way mirror," said Hirsch. "But nobody's back there and we're not interrogating you."
Courtney kept trying to look through the mirror. She didn't believe him.
"Why don't you two sit down and relax?" said the sergeant.
Mark and Courtney took seats next to each other at the table. D'Angelo stood by the door. Hirsch sat down and looked at the kids. The kids looked back at Hirsch. Hirsch nervously pulled at his eyebrow. It seemed as if he didn't know where to begin, so Courtney being Courtney decided to kick things off herself.
"So how can you suddenly believe us about the Pendragons?" she asked Hirsch.
"Mr. and Mrs. Pendragon are good friends of mine," he said. "My son Jimmy plays basketball with Bobby."
"Jimmy Hirsch!" shouted Mark. "I know him! Strong forward!"
Captain Hirsch nodded. This was good. Now they had an adult on their side. And he was a cop. A captain, no less. Now things were going to start happening.
"When was the last time you saw Bobby?"
he asked them. Mark knew the answer, but it was up to Courtney to give it.
"Last night at his house," she answered. "About an hour before the game."
"Did he say anything that would make you think he was going away?"
came the next question. Courtney and Mark looked at each other. They knew exactly where Bobby had gone. If the story on the parchment were true, then they knew how Uncle Press had taken him on the back of his motorcycle and left for a place on the far side of the universe called Denduron. But neither of them were sure if the outlandish story was really true, and they didn't want to sound totally insane. Besides, the pages didn't explain what had happened to the Pendragon's house. Mark and Courtney had decided, before going to the police, that they'd stick to the facts that could be proved. And it was pretty easy to prove that the house was gone. So, without discussing it again, they both decided to stick with the original plan.
"I was talking to Bobby at his house," answered Courtney. "His Uncle Press came in and I left. That's the last I saw him."
Captain Hirsch looked down at a piece of paper where he had written some notes.
"Right. Uncle Press,"
he said out loud, though it seemed like he was thinking it more than saying it.
Hirsch looked like he wanted to say something, but wasn't sure if it was a good idea or not. He looked to Sergeant D'Angelo for guidance.
"I think you should tell them, Captain," said the sergeant.
"Tell us what?"
asked Mark. Obviously, these policemen had some disturbing information. Captain Hirsch stood up and paced nervously.
"After you spoke with Sergeant D'Angelo, he told me about your visit," began Hirsch. "Frankly, he didn't believe you because he couldn't find any information on the Pendragons."
"But you know them," interjected Courtney.
"Yes, I know them," said Hirsch. "I've been to their house many times."
"And the house is gone," added Mark.
Hirsch didn't continue right away. He looked at the two kids, then to Sergeant D'Angelo. Finally, he said,
"Yeah, the house is gone. This may be a small police department in a small town, but we have access to pretty much any piece of information that's part of the public record," he said. "After you came in here, we did a computer search for the Pendragons and found nothing."
"What do you mean, nothing?"
asked Courtney.
"No police record?"
"No, I mean absolutely nothing," said Hirsch.
A hint of frustration was creeping into his voice.
"No birth certificates, no driver's licenses, no social security numbers, no bank accounts, no deeds, no electric bills, no school records, no credit cards, no nothing. The Pendragons didn't just disappear. It's like they never even existed."
Hirsch paced faster. He was getting upset because what he was saying didn't make sense. Yet it was true. Finally, Mark said,
"But they do exist, don't they? I mean, we know them."
"I know," snapped Hirsch. "I've had dinner at their house. I've driven Bobby to Boy Scouts. Here's another one for you. We scanned back copies of the newspaper where Mr. Pendragon works and couldn't find a single article he had written. But I remember reading them. I've discussed some of those articles with him."
This was getting stranger by the second. Disappearing is one thing, but having someone's whole history vanish seemed downright impossible.
"What about Uncle Press?"
asked Mark nervously.
"Again, nothing," answered Hirsch. "There is nothing we can find to prove that any of these people ever existed,
except in our memories," added Courtney.
That was a chilling thought. If what the captain said were true, the only thing left of Bobby and his family were the memories they all held, and the parchment papers in Mark's bag. Captain Hirsch sat back down at the table and looked to the kids with pleading eyes. This had turned his orderly policeman's mind inside out.
"Kids,"
he said, with a touch of desperation,
"help me out here. If there is anything you can add, anything that might help us figure out what happened to the Pendragons, please tell us."
Mark and Courtney had plenty to add. It was all sitting in Mark's backpack on the table in front of them. All they had to do was slide it over to Captain Hirsch. He would read the pages and take over. That's what adults did. They took over and fixed things. It wasn't Courtney's call. The letters were to Mark. If they were going to tell the police about the pages, it would have to be Mark's decision. Courtney saw that he was staring at the pack. She knew exactly what was going through his mind. He was debating whether or not to give over the pages. He then looked to her, and they made eye contact. Courtney wished that she had some way of helping him make the decision, but she honestly didn't know the right thing to do. So she gave him a slight, helpless shrug that said, "You're on your own."
"Well?"
asked Hirsch.
"Can you guys think of anything else?"
Mark took a deep breath, turned to Hirsch and said,
"No, we're just as confused as you are."
Decision made. Courtney picked up on Mark's lead and added,
"Yeah, we're pretty freaked out."
Hirsch took a deep, tired sigh and stood up, saying,
"Okay, we're going to start an investigation. Tell your parents, tell your friends, tell anybody who'll listen. If they hear anything about the Pendragons, have them call me, okay?"
Courtney and Mark nodded. Hirsch then gave each of them a business card with his phone number on it. Mark grabbed his pack, and they headed out. Once they were out of the building, they walked silently for a long while. The police station was right near Stony Brook Avenue, which was the main business street in town. Most of the shops and restaurants were there. Since there was no mall in Stony Brook, the Ave, as they called it, was where everybody hung out. But Courtney and Mark weren't interested in any of the temptations that the Ave held that day. They walked by the CD silo without even a glance into the window. They weren't tempted by the smell of the best French fries in the world coming from Garden Poultry Deli. They had no interest in ice cream from the Scoop. And they didn't even think of going to the library. The front steps of the library was where everyone stopped first on a trip to the Ave, because you were sure to find someone you knew there. But not today. Not for Courtney and Mark. Somehow these familiar haunts didn't seem so familiar anymore. Everything looked the same, but the last few hours had opened their eyes to the possibility that the world didn't work exactly the way they thought it did. Between Bobby's adventure and the strange disappearance of the Pendragons, everything they'd ever believed was thrown into question. With thoughts like this running through their heads, somehow grabbing a box of fries at Garden Poultry Deli didn't seem all that appetizing. So the two walked past the usual places where their friends hung out and went into a small, quiet pocket park that was sandwiched between two buildings. They sat down on a park bench and stared at the ground. Finally, Mark looked to Courtney and asked softly,
"Should I have told them about Bobby's letter?" "I don't know," was Courtney's reply. "I don't know what to think anymore."
Mark tried to put his feelings into words.
"I have a feeling," he began, "that there's an important reason Bobby is sending me his story."
"Why? We haven't even read what he wants yet," said Courtney.
"Yeah, I know. But I think it's more than that. I've got a feeling that something big is going on, and Bobby's only one part of it. There's some serious stuff going on here. I mean, like, cosmic stuff. Am I being weird?"
"Weird," chuckled Courtney. "How could anything sound weird now?"
"Exactly. The idea of travelers who understand languages, and territories, and flumes that send you across space and time, that stuff changes everything we know about how things work."
This made Courtney fall silent. Mark was right. Up until now, she was only thinking about Bobby and the Pendragons, but the implications of what they were reading were totally huge. Too huge to comprehend. Mark continued.
"As we were sitting with the police, I thought about what might happen if I gave them Bobby's story. I came up with two possibilities. One was that they'd announce it to the world. There'd be a huge furor, and we'd be smack in the center of it. Remember, I might still get more pages. I don't think Bobby would want that kind of uproar, especially if he wants me to help him. If he did, he would have started right off by telling me to take his story to the newspapers."
"What's the other possibility?" asked Courtney.
"The exact opposite might happen. The stuff Bobby wrote about might be so disturbing to the world that they'd bury the whole thing and pretend it never happened. Kind of like the aliens from Roswell or the Kennedy assassination. People don't like to hear that their nice, orderly world isn't what they thought it was. I wouldn't blame them. I'm not so thrilled about it myself."
"There's a third possibility," added Courtney.
"People may think we're responsible. Everyone wants easy answers, and the easiest answer is that we made the whole thing up. It would be easier for people to think it's all a hoax than to believe there are people who jump through wormholes and travel through the universe."
It was hard to believe that only a few hours ago their biggest concern was that Bobby Pendragon had missed a basketball game. Courtney looked to Mark and asked,
"What do you think we should do?"
Before he could answer, someone reached in from behind, grabbed his backpack, and yanked it out of his hands. Courtney and Mark looked up in surprise.
"What you got, Diamond? More magazines?"
It was Andy Mitchell, the kid who caught Mark in the boys' room reading Bobby's first journal. He fumbled with the clasps on Mark's pack, trying to open it. Mark jumped to his feet, shouting,
"Mitchell, give it back!"
Mark lunged at him, but Mitchell danced away.
"Oh, come on," laughed Mitchell. "Don't you want to share?"
He held the pack out toward Mark. Mark swiped at it, but Mitchell pulled it away and laughed.
"How bad you want it back?" Mitchell taunted. "Bad enough to swim with the rats for it?"
He backed toward a storm drain in the curb. It was plenty big enough for the pack to fit through.
"Don't!"
Mark shouted desperately. Mitchell dangled the pack over the drain.
"Will you give me for it?"
"What do you want?"
asked Mark nervously. Mitchell thought for a moment, then spotted something on Mark's hand.
"I'll trade the pack for that big old ring."
Mark couldn't give up the ring, no way, but he didn't want to lose the pages either. He hadn't read what Bobby wanted him to do yet.
"Think fast, Diamond,"
snickered Mitchell as he dangled the pack over the storm drain.
"The pack or the ring, pack or the ring."
Mark didn't know what to do. Suddenly, a steely, strong hand clamped down on Mitchell's wrist. He looked up and came face to face with Courtney. She had been calmly watching the scene from the bench. She might not have known how to deal with the mysterious disappearance of Bobby and the Pendragons, or the fact that the world had just turned upside down, but the one thing she knew how to handle was a bully like Andy Mitchell. She squeezed his wrist and stuck her nose in his face.
"Drop that in the sewer," she said through clenched teeth, "and you're going in after it, head first."
They stood that way for a long moment. Finally, after what seemed like a lifetime, Mitchell smiled.
"Jeez, I was just kidding around," he said.
Courtney reached over with her other hand and grabbed the pack. Once she had it, she let Mitchell go. He pulled away quickly while rubbing his wrist to get the circulation flowing again.
"It was just a goof,"
he said, trying to save face.
"Where'd you get that butt-ugly ring anyway?"
Mark and Courtney stared at the guy until he felt so uncomfortable that the only thing he could do was leave.
"Jeez, lighten up,"
he said, as he turned and jogged away. Courtney tossed the pack to Mark.
"Thanks,"
said Mark with a bit of embarrassment. Now that the crisis was over, he knew he hadn't handled it well.
"I hate that weenie," she said. "We've got to go somewhere and finish reading this," Mark said seriously. "I'm nervous about having these out in public. Let's go back to my house."
Courtney said uncomfortably.
"No offense, but your room is, like, rank."
Mark looked down, embarrassed.
"Hey, don't sweat it," she said with a smile. "All guys' rooms are rank. It's just the way it is. Let's go to my house."
It was a short walk to Courtney's house, and neither of them said much along the way. Both had their minds on the pages. There were a lot of questions to be answered, but one stood out above all others. What was the dangerous favor that Bobby wanted Mark to do for him? Courtney was dying to know. So was Mark. But he wasn't all that sure he liked the idea of having to do something dangerous, no matter how important it was. Up until now, Mark's idea of doing something dangerous was to ring somebody's doorbell on mischief night and run away. Given what Bobby was going through, the stakes here were a wee bit higher than that. They arrived at Courtney's house, which was very much like Mark's. They both lived in a quiet suburban neighborhood. But rather than go to Courtney's room, Courtney took Mark down to the basement, where her father had a workshop. Mark had a fleeting moment of disappointment that he wouldn't get to see the inner sanctum of the glorious Courtney Chetwynd, but there were larger problems to deal with. The two sat down on an old, dusty couch, and Mark opened his pack. He laid the precious pages out on a coffee table in front of them. The two hesitated a moment. As much as they were dying with curiosity about what happened next to Bobby, they were also a little bit frightened about what the pages contained and what new and disturbing wonders they would reveal. They each took a breath. Then Courtney looked to Mark and said,
"You ready?"
"Yeah."
They looked down at the pages and picked up where they had left off. "I was going to get myself out of here and kiss this place goodbye, with or without Uncle Press." Journal Number 2. Continued. Denduron.
My plan was to climb back to the top of the mountain, get past those cannibal quig beasts, find the gate that leads to the flume, and get the hell out of here. Simple, right? Yeah, sure.
I'm not even sure I could find that stupid cave again, let alone survive the climb through the snow and the quigs. Still, my mind was made up. It was better than staying here. But it wasn't going to happen today. The suns were going down, and it was getting dark. Yeah, that's right. Suns. Plural. Remember I told you there were three suns? Well, they all set at the same time, but in opposite parts of the sky. North, south, and east. Or whatever they use for directions around here. I figured I had to spend the night and sneak away once it got light. Besides, I was hungry. I hadn't eaten anything since I had a banana and some raspberry Pop-Tarts before the basketball game I never made it to. Lore brought me to a hut that was like the one I woke up in, only smaller. In one corner was a pile of furry animal skins. Lore pointed to them and gave me a simple command. Sit. I did. It was smelly, but comfortable. There was a small stone fireplace where Lore quickly and expertly made a fire that gave us light and took the chill off. Osa arrived soon after with a cloth sack that I quickly found out was full of food.
Yes!
We all sat around the fire and shared loaves of crunchy bread, some weird fruit that looked like an orange but you ate like an apple, and some soft nut-like things that tasted like licorice. Maybe it was because I was so hungry, but this odd meal was delicious. I would have preferred some fries from Garden Poultry Deli on the Ave, but this did just fine. While we ate, Osa gave me some strange instructions.
"Is there someone back on Second Earth whom you trust above all others?" she asked.
It didn't take me long to come up with the answer. I told her it was you, Mark. Sure, my family's cool, and of course I trust them, but a friend is someone who gives you trust because they want to, not because they have to. Osa handed me a stack of blank parchment paper that was all yellowed and crunchy. She also gave me a crude pen that looked like it was carved from a tree branch, along with a small bowl of black ink.
"It is important that you write down all that is happening to you," explained Osa. "Every chance you get, write your thoughts, your feelings, and describe the things that you see. Think of it as a journal."
"Why?" was my obvious question.
"Because you will send them to your friend for safekeeping," she answered. "I will not lie to you, Pendragon. This is a dangerous journey. If anything should happen to you, this journal will be the only record of what you have done."
Yikes, that sounded grim. It was like she was asking me to write out my last will and testament. Part of me wanted to refuse because doing what she asked made me feel like I was going along with the program. And I definitely was not. On the other hand, what she said made sense. If anything happened to me, nobody would know the real story. I didn't like that. If I was going to go down, I wanted everybody to know why. "Well, how are we going to get it to Mark?" I asked.
"Write first," she said. "When you are ready, I will show you."
That was interesting. If she could get these pages to you, that meant she knew how to use the flume in the other direction. Maybe this would be my chance to find a way home. So, with that in mind, I took the pen and went to work. I set myself up next to the fire, using a piece of wood on my lap as a desk. It took a while to get the knack of using the pen because it wasn't exactly a big rollerball. I had to dip the pointy end in the ink and scratch the words out on the paper. It was a pain. But after a while, I got to where I could write a whole sentence without having to re-dip. Across from me, Lore was doing the same thing. It felt like we were doing homework together. As she scratched out her thoughts on the same kind of parchment paper, I couldn't help but wonder what she was writing about me. I knew she thought I was a toady boy, but having survived a brush with St. Dane gave me a little more credibility. On the other hand, who cares? Tomorrow, I was out of here. That's how I spent the rest of the night. I rode for a while, and when my eyes got heavy, I sacked out on the animal skins. I'd sleep for a little bit, then wake up and write some more. Lore did the same thing. Osa was in and out of the hut. She'd come in to put some wood on the fire, then leave again. I wondered if she was getting any sleep at all. I got as far as writing about Uncle Press being captured by Kagan's knights, and then I crashed for good. The next thing I knew, Osa was gently shaking me to wake up.
"It is morning, Pendragon," she said softly.
I was sleeping deeply and had to force my eyes open. There was light in the hut,
but I could tell it was early because there were no shadows and the birds were singing. I looked around to see that the fire had gone out, and Lore was gone.
"Give me your journal," she commanded.
I sat up and gathered the pages I had written. She took them, rolled them up, and tied them with a leather cord. She then walked to the center of the hut, sat down cross-legged, and placed something on the floor. It was a big, old, clunky silver ring with a gray stone mounted in the center. From where I was sitting, I could see there was some kind of inscription engraved around the stone, but I had no idea what it meant. Osa looked to make sure I was watching, then reached down to the ring, touched her finger to the stone, and said,
"Second Earth."
What I saw next sent a bolt of adrenaline through me so quickly that I was shocked out of any last remnant of sleep. The gray stone in the ring started to glow. It acted like the flume had when it brought me here. The flume was made of gray rock, just like the ring. When I said Dendron, the gray rock of the flume had started to glow, just like the ring. Bright light shot from the facets of the stone and washed the walls of the hut, just like the lights in the flume. And like the flume, I started to hear the strange musical notes. Then the ring started to twitch and grow. The band actually stretched out and got bigger until it was about the size of a frisbee. But inside the circle, where the floor should have been, was a hole. It was like this ring opened up a mini flume to... where? Osa took the rolled up parchment pages and dropped them into the ring. The pages disappeared as if they had been dropped into a hole in the floor. Then the ring snapped back to normal size, and everything ended. No lights, no sound, no hole. Just the ring. Osa picked it up and put it into a leather pouch that hung from around her neck.
"Your friend Mark has your journal," she said, and got up to leave.
That was it. No explanation, no nothing. I jumped to my feet to head her off. "Whoa! You can't pull that hocus-pocus number and not tell me what happened," I demanded.
"I told you what happened," she said calmly. "I sent your journal to Mark Diamond."
She tried to continue out of the hut, but I got in front of her.
"But how? Is that like a portable flume?"
Obviously, my mind was in overdrive.
"There are many things to know about being a traveler, Pendragon," she said patiently. "Once you are more comfortable, this ring will be yours, and you will be able to send your journals to Mark Diamond yourself. Until then, be satisfied to know that the power contained in the ring is similar to the power found in the flumes."
I wasn't going to give up that easily.
"But how can it find Mark?"
Osa took a deep breath, like she was getting tired of my questions. Too bad. She knew how this stuff worked. I didn't.
"I gave another ring to Mark Diamond," she said.
"What? You saw Mark? No, wait, you went to Earth? When? How? Did you tell him I'm here? Did you see my parents? Did you..."
Osa put a hand to my mouth to shut me up. She was gentle, but firm.
"I went to Second Earth and gave Mark Diamond the ring," she explained. "That is all. I saw no one else. No more questions."
She took her hand away and started out of the hut.
"Just one more,"
I called after her. Osa turned back to me, waiting to hear.
"Does this ring thing work both ways? I mean, if we can send things to Mark, can he send things to us?"
Osa smiled. It was the kind of smile I'd see from my mother when I thought I was being clever about trying to keep something from her. That smile said, "I know exactly what you're thinking, smart guy. You can't fool me."
"The rings can transport small objects, but they only work for travelers,"
was her answer.
"Mark Diamond would not be able to send you anything. Now, if you wish to bathe yourself, there is a river that runs a few hundred feet south of the village."
She left, and my mind went into hyperdrive.
This ring business had just opened up a whole new world of possibilities. Maybe I didn't need to get all the way to the top of the mountain after all. Maybe the ring could grow big enough for me to jump into it. And if I'm a traveler, then the ring will work for me. Yes! For the first time in a long while, I felt as if I had a shot at taking control of my life again.
when the time was right, I'd get the ring from Osa and punch my ticket out of here. That was the new plan, and it felt good. Heck, anything would be better than climbing that mountain and getting past the Quigs. So with a new sense of hope, I left the hut to start the day. The Suns